What I have to do this morning is get through Acts 2 and 3 in 2 hours, which is not possible, so I'll just admit defeat before I begin. But what I am going to do, I want to emphasize a couple of themes, and what I'm going to be doing is following a couple of specific ideas that I think are extremely important and try to watch those as they move through those acts. So there are things I'm going to be neglecting, and I apologize. They are deserving of treatment, but I don't have the time. So on we go. I want to make one point, one last point in connection with the scene with the ghost. Father Doran gave a very clear, concise, thoroughly Catholic vision of the discernment of spirits. We were just talking here a moment ago. Hamlet would have known his catechism. He would have had a good bit of that. Those things would have been known to him. Then what is the problem? And I think the problem, again, is this, and it needs to be emphasized. He is not thinking with a clear brain at this point. You have a young man who is hyper-emotionally charged, back from the university where he's been filled with doubt, facing a family situation in upheaval, a country where he is the prince, which seems to have gone rotten, and then with the ghost of his father coming, what we see, and what I tried to make clear last night, simply added complications. If he could have sat down and read the ghost speech, perhaps he could have analyzed it. To have the ghost of one's dead father standing before you in the midst of all this, the response is something less than clear. So the important thing to remember is we're dealing with a drama here, okay? We have a character in a certain situation, with a certain emotional sense and a certain intellectual frame of mind trying to deal with all this. And Shakespeare makes clear to us that Hamlet is not in his best wits, let's put it that way. I'm not getting into the whole question of is he really insane or not. Let's just say he's pushed to the edge. He's clearly on the brink of something. And it is especially true after the scene with the ghost where he comes back and talks to Horatio and the other soldiers. And Horatio, who is always clear-minded, okay, we can say that for Horatio. He's balanced, he's clear-minded. Says at one point, "These are wild and whirling words, my lord." "What are you talking about? You're not making any sense," says Horatio to Hamlet. And that I think we can take as an indication of at least how his friend is viewing him at that point. "You're not making any sense. I don't know what you're talking about. These are wild and whirling words, my lord." And indeed, that's the situation in which we find the character, okay? Now, having said that, let's head into Act 2. I'm not going to pause on the scene with Polonius and the spy Rinaldo, other than to say this. We have a pattern that is running through Act 2. We have the older generation attempting somehow to control the younger generation. The first indication of it is here with Polonius sending Rinaldo off to Paris to check out what Laertes is up to. That is followed at the beginning of the next scene with Claudius and Gertrude, who have sent for Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to come to the court to keep an eye on Hamlet. See the pattern here? Rinaldo is to keep an eye on Laertes. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are to keep an eye on young Hamlet. And then the ambassadors come back from Norway, and the old king who has replaced the new king, uncle of young Fortinbras, who has replaced the dead old king Fortinbras, says, "I didn't know what my nephew was up to. I will keep a closer eye on him. I thought he was going off to battle in Poland. It turns out you're right. He was raising arms against Denmark. I'm putting the lid on this kid. And I'll watch him." So that throughout Act 2, with each of those, if you will, parallel stories of the three young men, we have the older generation aware that there is trouble of some kind brewing. and notice the difference in kinds of trouble. With Laertes, Polonius is afraid he's leading a wild life. It's moral trouble. With Hamlet, they want to find out what he's thinking, what's going on inside him, what's in his head. It's intellectual trouble. With young Fortinbras, it's politics, it's military, it's the trouble of action. What's this kid up to? What's he going to do? He's raising an army. Who is he going to attack? So with the three young men, three different spheres of human action, if you will, and in each case, the older generation is now aware there's something wrong and they have to step in and do something. Now, please look at the way they're dealing with it. Polonius is sending, I'm in Act 2, Scene 1, right at the beginning of Act 2. Polonius sends off Reinaldo and says, well, you can, you know, find out the other Danskers, the other Danes who are in Paris, find out what company he's keeping, what kind of money he's spending, find out if they know my son. Take you as tour, some distant knowledge of him is thus. I know his father and his friends, and in part him. Do you mark this, Reinaldo? I very well, my lord. And in part him, but you may say not well, but if it be he, I mean he's very wild. Addicted, so and so. And there put on him what forgeries you please. Marry, none so rank as may dishonor him. Take heed of that. But, sir, such wanton, wild, and usual slips as our companions noted and most known to youth and liberty. As gaming, my lord? Aye, or drinking, fencing, swearing, quarreling, drabbing. You may go so far. My lord, that would dishonor him. The spy, who's Reinaldo, who's going over, says, I can't say that about your son. His first impulse is to say, well, should I just say he's gambling? Oh, no, yeah, go beyond that. Say he's drinking, fencing, swearing, quarreling, running around with wanton women. This is the boy's father speaking. What have we got here? Further indication of the total corruption of Denmark. Not only is the state of Denmark rotten, but the people in it who are in control of it are clearly rotten. This is Polonius being rotten again. This is the father sending someone to France to slander his own son. My lord, that would dishonor him, says Reinaldo. Faith, no, as you may seize it in the charge. You must not put another scandal on him that he is open to incontinency. Okay, don't pretend he does it all the time. Whew. It's very unpleasant. This is singularly unpleasant. But it, again, what do we have? We have a total crack between the generations, a complete break between fathers and sons. This scene follows the scene between the ghost and Hamlet. There is a distance, a gap between these generations. All the more reason for Hamlet's turbulent mind and spirits, all right? Now, he sends off Reinaldo, and in comes Ophelia, who gives the account, you'll remember the scene in the Zeffirelli film of Hamlet coming into her. Here, Ophelia gives the speech describing Hamlet suddenly appearing, looking very strange. Polonius says, mad for thy love? Ophelia, my lord, I do not know, but truly I do fear it. I'm afraid because I've done as you told me and sent back his letters and have not been talking to him. That's what's caused this. What said he? Ophelia says, he took me by the wrist and held me hard. Then goes he to the length of all his arm, and with his other hand, thus o'er his brow, he falls to such perusal of my face as he would draw it. Long stayed he so. At last, a little shaking of mine arm, and thrice his head thus waving up and down, he raised a sigh so piteous and profound as it did seem to shatter all his bulk and end his being. He doesn't say a word. He stares at her, and then heaves a terrible sigh, so profound that Ophelia says it seemed to end his being. She doesn't know what's wrong. Polonius doesn't know what's wrong. We should know what's wrong. If you recall, the one thing he depended on was love. The one thing he did not doubt was love, particularly Ophelia's love. He has come back and discovered his mother's love is in question, which has been followed by Ophelia rejecting him, sending the letters back, refusing to see him. At what moment? The very moment when he has needed her most. He can confide to some degree in Horatio, but the fact of the matter is this. A young man can find certain things to his friends and other things to the young woman, the sensitive soul that he is fond of. That's been cut off. That is broken. That little scene, occasionally critics will say, well, he's play-acting, he knows that word will get back to the king that he behaved weird. That seems absolutely genuine to me and consistent with his problem. He believes he has now lost that love, or he has come to doubt that love, or that love is up for grabs like everything else he believed in. Which means there is nothing left for him to hold on to in this world. He now doubts everything, and supposedly this mission of revenge has been put on him. Polonius simply takes it as, sure enough, he's in love, he's mad for thy love, that's the problem, I will go take care of it. Come, go we to the king, this must be known, all right? Ophelia constantly following her father's orders. Act 2, Scene 2, the beginning very quickly. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern arrive. They have been called by the king. They have been called for one purpose, and that is indeed to spy. It is a parallel with the opening of the preceding scene. These structural moments are extremely important. Shakespeare, throughout the plays, is always working by parallels. And parallel actions should be read one against the other because we can learn things by setting them up, so we have that parallel action. The ambassadors return. And there's good news. There is peace in our time. Okay, young Fortinbras has been held down. Claudius's political move has worked. We have avoided war. Polonius has his great scene where he just talks endlessly without getting to the point. It is a moment of delightful comedy. But again, tells us something about what's going on inside the man's head, which is very little indeed. But his mouth is extremely active. And then, the comic scene between Polonius and Hamlet, where Hamlet mistakes Polonius for a fishmonger. Polonius says, no, I'm not a fishmonger. Hamlet says, then I would you were so honest a man. Well, it's too bad you're not. I hope you are at least as honest as a fishmonger is. Honest, my lord, Hamlet says, aye, sir, to be honest as this world goes is to be one man picked out of 10,000. And that's not a joke. That's not a joke at that. Okay, that's, or it's one of those truths that's hidden behind a joke. At this moment in the play, he doesn't have a sense that there's honesty out there anywhere. It does seem to be gone. Maybe there's one honest man in 10,000, and maybe it's the guy who's down at the dock weighing his fish accurately before he sells it. That may be what honesty has come to in Denmark. And given what we're seeing of the state of Denmark, that could very well be right. In terms of those in power, we're not seeing a whole lot of honesty anywhere. He suddenly asks, have you a daughter? I have, my lord. Let her not walk in the sun. Conception is a blessing, but as your daughter may conceive, friend, look to it. And now he's making jokes about Ophelia. This is beginning a pattern of Hamlet's treatment of Ophelia, which is about to change. What have we known before? He has loved her. There has been a close connection. But now at this moment, having bid a kind of farewell to her silently, he's going to start attacking. And this is a pattern we've got to follow through the next couple of acts. The important question is this. Who indeed have we met in Denmark that is honest? Ophelia is. She is honest. She is obedient. She is innocent. We don't find that anywhere else, and she is now becoming the subject of Hamlet's anger, which again tells us something has happened to him that is not good. We can understand the nature of the confusion, the nature of the problem. She is being manipulated by her father. She is following her father's orders. She is part of that court. She is in that court. It may look like she's corrupt, but I think she is also being punished because she's a woman. And she's being punished for his anger at his mother. And he is taking it out on all women now, including Ophelia, who seems to have moved away from him, who seems to have made a break with him, okay? Now, the death motif rises up again. It's a little joke. Will you walk out of the air, my lord, Polonius says? Into my grave, says Hamlet. We're moving towards that great soliloquy that will open the third act. It's clearly on his mind. And Polonius then says, well, I will take my leave of you. You cannot, sir, take from me anything that I will more willingly part with all except my life. Except my life. Except my life. Gibson's reading of that was superb, by the way. One of those moments when he just triumphed. He meant it. He meant it. Life is becoming an awful burden for Hamlet. But please notice, he's thinking about death, the grave, giving up life at what moment? Shortly after he's had a mission placed on him. He's not thinking about going out and doing what the ghost told him, not at this point. What he's meditating on is death. The meditation is about death at this point. Now, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern come in. He's surprised to see them. He suspects they've been brought there. He begins grilling them, and they finally admit it. I'm a ways into the scene with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, where Guildenstern admits, "My lord, we were sent for." He gets the truth out of them. Please notice, he's able to seek the truth and get it out. Guildenstern admits it. And then Hamlet says, I will tell you why. Look carefully at this speech. It's a fairly long one. It's a famous one. It's hugely important at this moment. One reason I'm going through this play scene by scene is try to get a sense of the shape of the character. Because the character shapes the play. I will tell you why. So shall my anticipation prevent your discovery, and your secrecy to the king and queen molt no feather. I have of late, but wherefore I know not. Top of 42 in the Dover edition. I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, forgone all custom of exercises. And indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. He looks out at the earth, and what does he see? Barrenness. Barrenness. There's nothing there. Please notice the change. This is not an unweeded garden that grows to seed. What's happened to that image? It's sterility now. It's sterility. There is no life. There is nothing growing, not even weeds going to seed. The earth seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave or hanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. The earth is barren and the air stinks. There's nothing below, there's nothing above. Please notice the form of this speech. We're in prose. This is not poetry. And always in Shakespeare, when we shift from poetry to prose, there is a coming down to earth. This is not, the language is beautiful, but this is not poetry. This is matter of fact. This is of the day and of the time. This is not heightened. What a piece of work is man. How noble in reason. How infinite in faculty. In form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? The earth is rock, sterile rock. The sky is stinking vapors, and man is dust. Expressed in prose, this is a measure of where our hero is at this moment in the play. Man delights not me. And then stage direction written into the play. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern have to laugh at that moment. Smile and laugh. No, nor woman neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so. So Hamlet says, man delights not me. And they go, and he thinks, yeah, you think women delight me. Well, they don't. Which again tells you what's on his mind. They say, no, that's not what we meant. We meant if man doesn't like you, then you're not going to want to see the players who have just arrived. But he takes their smiling to be what? Or you still love women? And he says, no, I don't. I take no delight in women. It's consistent with what's in his head. The sense of betrayal by women. Mother, Ophelia, betrayal of love. That's what's in his head. The only thing that had kept him going, lost. The players have arrived. The players have arrived. And indeed, he perks up. Indeed, he shows some excitement. There's a small little passage here I want to talk about. It's a famous one, and it's often looked at in terms of theater history, and it comes right after this. The players have come. How did they travel? Well, they're out touring now. Why is that? Well, it's because they're having trouble staying in the city. Why are they having trouble staying in the city? Rosencrantz explains it. Nay, their endeavor keeps in the wonted pace. They're still good players. But there is, sir, an eyrie of children, little Iases, that cry out on the top of the question and are most tyrannically clapped for. These are now the fashion, and so berattle the common stages, so they call them, that many wearing rapiers are afraid of goose quills and dare scarce come thither. This had happened in London right at the time that Hamlet was being written. Children's companies were being formed. You could go and see grown-up plays performed by little kids. But it would have been all boys, of course. And they became hugely popular. And part of it was just how weird it was to see little children doing all of this. Part of it was novelty. Part of it was strangeness. Part of it was seeing little kids trying to pretend to be grown-ups. There's a wonderful, awful old Hollywood movie from the 40s. It's a Western called The Terror of Tiny Town that's cast entirely with midgets. It's one of the most uproarious movies ever made because it is an absolutely serious Western film. Could be a John Wayne film or a Roy Rogers film, but you've got nothing but midgets in it. It's like the Munchkins from The Wizard of Oz doing a Western. And you've got these little midget men walking around wearing gun belts and walking into little miniature saloons and talking with their high squeaky voices. It's uproariously funny. And the joke of it, of course, is that it's entirely out of place. It's totally out of keeping. The whole point of a Western is it's a grown-up form, the battle between good and evil. The whole point of the Elizabethan drama was the seriousness of these plays. Well, now they had little kids on the stage doing them, and they were popular. This is often looked at in terms of theater history. There's Shakespeare criticizing those children's companies that were drawing business away from the Globe Theater. And that's true. We do learn something about theater history in that little moment. But Shakespeare would never include in a play something like that without giving it a purpose. And what's going on here? What's going on here is calling upon someone who is too young, too inexperienced, and not able to do the job to pretend to be a grown-up in a grown-up world. And we have a little reflection on Hamlet himself. He is still an adolescent. He is a troubled adolescent. In some ways, he is a kid. And now the world is calling on him to perform the part of a wise adult, and he's not ready any more than these little children actors were able to perform and be adults in adult dramas. I'm convinced that's why that passage is in there. It's fascinating, but it's useful in terms of the play as well. Moving on. The players arrive, the players come in, Hamlet greets them. He is indeed glad to see them. For the same reason that when things get really, really bad and you're really depressed and nothing's going your way, or at least I'm speaking for myself, when I get really, really depressed and nothing's going my way and the world is too much to bear, I go to the movies. I get a big tub of popcorn and I'll sit and watch almost anything because for a couple of hours, I don't have to think about things, okay? This is standard. No, of course Hamlet's delighted to see the players. They just don't have popcorn at their performances. But it's the same impulse. It's diversion. It's a way of forgetting about what's going on. And yet, in a very curious way, it is consistent with what's going on. What is Hamlet's problem? He's going to make it very clear at the end of this act, after the scene with the players. He has been called upon to do something. The ghost, for good or ill, has given him a mission. He is supposed to go out there and perform an action. He's to kill the king. He is, if you will, supposed to act. Defined as taking an action in the world. He doesn't want to do it, and instead, what is he going to watch? He's going to watch a group of other people act. That is, perform in make-believe fashion. So we have acting, what he's supposed to do, and acting, which is make-believe, which can divert him for a while. And he is well aware of the difference between the two. He's going to comment on it. The actors arrive. Hamlet greets them. Wonderful moment. I won't pause on it. I'll just note it. He refers to Polonius as Jephthah. O Jephthah, judge of Israel, what a treasure thou hadst thou. I assume you know the story. If you don't, go look it up. It's pertinent. Okay. And he immediately calls for a speech. You're here. Do something for me. Okay? Perform for me. But he doesn't leave it up to them to perform. He calls for a specific speech. I heard thee speak me a speech once, but it was never acted, or if it was, not above once. For the play, I remember, pleased not the million, 'twas caviar to the general. It was just too rich for most people, okay? But I know you know this play, I heard it once, and he calls for a particular speech. 'Twas Aeneas' tale to Dido. Why is it on his mind? Why does it go there? The broken love, the unhappy love. Aeneas deserting Dido, and Dido commits suicide. In this case, Ophelia seems to have deserted him, and as we're going to find out, suicide is on his mind. We know he's been thinking thoughts of death. It makes sense that he goes back to that play. But then, having gone back to that play, he calls for a specific speech. Aeneas, where he speaks of Priam's slaughter. It's the moment when Troy falls. And Priam, king of Troy, is killed by Pyrrhus, from whose name we get the word Pyrrhic, okay, which you've gotten familiar with in just the last couple of days. And Hamlet begins the speech. He remembers the speech. He gets it wrong. It takes a couple of goes, but it's clear he's got a good memory and loves these things. He does the whole first part of the speech of Pyrrhus going out looking for Priam. Question is, why this speech? Why this speech? Polonius praises Hamlet's speaking of it. "For God, my lord, well spoken, with good accent and good discretion. You're a good actor. You're a good actor, Hamlet," says Polonius. The first player picks up the speech. Follow this, follow this. It's where the first player begins speaking. "Anon he finds him." That is, anon Pyrrhus finds old King Priam. Anon the young Greek hero finds the old Trojan king. Anon he finds him striking too short at Greeks. The old man is in the streets, swinging his sword, attempting to fight the Greeks, but the sword is falling too short. Why? He's old. He's tired. The burden is too great, and he can't reach the enemy. He can't get to the enemy. It makes sense why Hamlet wants this speech, needs to hear this speech. I got to pause for a moment. Tangent, tangent. I'm sitting in the theater watching a production of Hamlet. This is what happens when you actually know these plays. The first player comes out. They included this section. The first player is there and starts this speech and says, not anon he finds him striking too short at Greeks. He says, anon he finds him striking at two short Greeks. Two little Greek guys, and Priam's going, bam, bam, bam. Well, I became hysterical. I became absolutely hysterical. I couldn't stop laughing. I am in the theater guffawing. Nobody else knows what's funny. They look at me as if I'm weird. Anon he finds him. Whenever I hear that line now, I chuckle. Anon he finds him striking at two short Greeks. Well, all right. Anon he finds him striking too short at Greeks. I continue. His antique sword, rebellious to his arm, lies where it falls, repugnant to command. His sword is fighting his arm. His sword is rebellious. The sword won't do the job. And the sword falls and cannot be lifted. Priam can't fight. Priam is incapable of fighting. Unequal matched, Pyrrhus at Priam drives. Priam can't fight, so Pyrrhus comes at the old king. In rage, strikes wide. He is so angry, he lashes at Priam and misses. His passions and emotions are out of control, and he can't hit the proper object. This is hugely important. It's going to happen in the next act. Hugely important. In rage strikes wide, but the whiff and wind of his fell sword, the unnerved father falls. He doesn't land his sword on Priam, but the energy of that sword coming at Priam makes the old man fall to his knees. Even though he hasn't been touched, it's still too much for him. Then senseless Ilium, that's another word for Troy, seeming to feel this blow with flaming top, stoops to his base, and with a hideous crash takes prisoner Pyrrhus' ear. Okay, we have a moment. We have a moment. Suddenly, the king has an incident and gets Pyrrhus' ear. Ah. We've got an unfair battle going on, but we've got a battle. For lo, his sword, which was declining on the milky head of Reverend Priam, seemed in the air to stick. The old man's down, okay? Pyrrhus is ready. He raises his sword to cut his skull right in half. Eliminate the king. He raises the sword, and what happens? He can't do it. His sword seemed in the air to stick, so as a painted tyrant, Pyrrhus stood, and like a neutral to his will and matter, did nothing. There's the king, we're about to kill the king, we know why we're going to kill the king, we raise the sword, we've got him there, and Pyrrhus can't do it. This is the speech that Hamlet has requested. He is trying to resolve through art this problem that he feels internally. He can't act yet, take action. He needs an actor to act something out through him, through language, so he can begin to conceive of what the problem is. This is an incredibly complicated moment that has to do with Shakespeare's view of art, Hamlet's view of the players. It's a wonderful moment, but we can't pause on it. I have to go on. And of course, what finally happens is that sword falls. Eventually, action is taken, okay? With less remorse than Pyrrhus' bleeding sword now falls on Priam. The speech doesn't stop there, however. The speech doesn't stop there. It goes on. Hamlet prompts him and says, okay, I love this. First he insults Polonius. Polonius says, this is too long. And Hamlet says, it shall to the barbers with your beard. Prithee say on. And then says, he's for a jig or a tale of bawdry or he sleeps. I use that line in class a lot when my students fall asleep. If it's not a dance or a dirty story, then Polonius isn't interested and he falls asleep. It's a real slam on Polonius. He turns back to the player. Say on, come to Hecuba. Hecuba, the wife of Priam. The king is murdered and his widow survives. But who had seen the moblid queen, okay? Her head muffled up. And we get the vision of Hecuba running barefoot, covered up, through the streets of Troy, which is on fire, okay? Tears running down her face. Her king, her husband, is dead, and she's responding the way a good queen, a good wife, a good mother should respond. Gertrude should have covered herself up and run weeping through the streets of Denmark. Instead, she got remarried right away. Again, Hamlet is working something out through hearing this speech. Hecuba, the good queen, the good wife, the good mother, and we get the description of it. But as the player tells the story, the color of his face changes, his eyes fill with tears, and he weeps for Hecuba. We'll come back to that. It's in the soliloquy. Polonius stops the player at that point. Prithee no more. And Hamlet says, 'Tis well. I'll have thee speak out the rest of this soon. And off goes the players. He requests the specific play, the murder of Gonzago. Aye, my lord. We'll have it tomorrow night. You could, for a need, study a speech of some dozen or 16 lines, which I would set down and insert in it. Could you not? Aye, my lord. Very well, follow that, lord. And look you, mock him not. It's wonderful. Don't make fun of the old man. Question, is that because it's Hamlet's job to mock him? Is it because Hamlet feels he's already been mocked enough? We don't know, but it's one of those moments of real decency. Who knows where it comes from? Fascinating little moment, part of that complexity of character. But please notice what he's doing now. He has called the actors in, he's requested a speech, he requests a play, and now he is finally going to do something. What's he going to do? He's going to write. He's going to write a little additional speech of 16 lines to be inserted in the play. Hamlet, who was a talker, and then had some connection with being an actor, that is putting an antic disposition on before the court, is now turning into a writer. He's going to add this speech and have it inserted into the play that will be presented before Claudius. Now, we're at the big soliloquy that ends the second act. Just from the start, we have the soliloquy, "Now I am alone." This is the longest of the soliloquies. Far and away the longest of the soliloquies. "Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I." If you remember the first soliloquy, he wanted to disappear. He wanted to vanish. Melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. He wanted to be gone. Now we have something very different. It's a self-evaluation. I am a slave. The Prince of Denmark is calling himself a slave. He doesn't say to what or to whom. But at this moment, we can speculate what it is he's talking about. He is a rogue, that's obvious, not to be trusted, and peasant slave. He's there with the lowest of the low. He feels at the absolute bottom of the hierarchy in Denmark. "Oh, what a rogue and peasant slave am I." Notice where the line ends. I. Is it not monstrous that this player here, but in a fiction, in a dream of passion, could force his soul so to his own conceit that from her working all his visage wanned? Tears in his eyes, distraction in his aspect, a broken voice, and his whole function suiting with forms to his conceit. And all for nothing. For Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba, that he should weep for her? It's wonderful. I've just seen huge passion, and it was all phony. But it was completely believable. That actor was completely believable. He could force his soul to imitate a passion that was so grand and so believable that he wept. He is admiring the actor. And not in terms of action he's taken, but the fact that he can show emotion that seems genuine, even if it's only make-believe. And all for nothing. Why did he feel all that? Because Hamlet requested the speech. Because he's a performer, he says the speech. He got into it, he made it believable, he cries. All for nothing for Hecuba. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba? Please notice, it's not Pyrrhus he talks about. It's not Priam he talks about. It is the widowed queen. It's the mother figure again. What's the relationship between the player and Hecuba? What's the relationship between that man and that woman from mythology? That he should weep for her, and here we go. Now we get the other half of the comparison. Please notice how Hamlet is constantly comparing himself to others. Constantly, through the whole play. Always to his own disadvantage. "But no more like my father than I to Hercules," remember from the first soliloquy. What would he do? Had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have? What if he had a real reason to show emotion, the way I do? He would drown the stage with tears and cleave the general ear with horrid speech. Notice the image. Cleave means what? To cut in half. The image is of cutting the ear of the public in half with horrible speech. It's an image of attack. Why the ear? Because the ear hears speech. But where was the murderous distillment poured in his father? Into the ear. And now there's the sense of, if you will, an eye for an eye, an ear for an ear, and the image is of slashing down on an ear. Cleave the general ear with horrid speech. Make mad the guilty. Those who are guilty drive them mad. Madness appears again. And appall the free. Free in the sense of innocent. Terrify those who are innocent. In that line, we've got Hamlet and Ophelia. Madness and innocence. Madness and innocence. Confound the ignorant and amaze indeed the very faculties of eye and ear. Amaze in the sense of confuse. Confuse. If he put forth the amount of emotion that would be appropriate for what I'm feeling, the audience would sit there horrified, having no idea what was going on. Well, that's a clear depiction of Hamlet's own state. Amaze indeed the very faculties of eyes and ears, yet I. Please notice that short line, that 1 foot line as the terms of the comparison continue, yet I. What happens when he speaks of himself? The normal 5 foot line sinks to 1 foot. He's barely there. He's hardly anything at all. He speaks of himself and he can't make up even a full line of iambic pentameter. He only gets 1 foot out of it. Yet I. A dull and muddy-mettled rascal. There's his description of himself. Yet duller shouldst thou be than the fat weed on Lethe's wharf. Remember the word? The ghost used it to him. If you don't act, you would be dull like a fat weed. And now he's using the word. A dull and muddy-mettled rascal. I have no spirit. There's no energy in me. There's no life in me. There's nothing in me. Peak. Mope. Like John of dreams, unpregnant of my cause. Not filled up with my cause. No real interest in my cause. And can say nothing. Please notice the verb. Not and can do nothing, but and can say nothing. I can't even talk about what I'm supposed to do. We're still on the level of the actor simply describing what the situation is. We're not close to action yet. And can say nothing. No, not for a king upon whose property and most dear life a damned defeat was made. The king was killed. I know it. I know he was murdered. And I can't even say anything about it. I don't care. I'm not particularly interested. I can't get upset about it. Then what's he upset about? Because he's clearly upset. What he's upset about is his own dullness. His own emptiness. Am I a coward? Fair question. Is it cowardice? Who calls me villain? Breaks my pate across. Plucks off my beard and blows it in my face. Tweaks me by the nose. Gives me the lie in the throat as deep as the lungs. Who does me this? Ha! Zoons, I should take it. They can come up. They can taunt me. They can insult me. And... Who cares? For it cannot be but I am pigeon-livered and lack gall to make oppression bitter, or ere this I should have fatted all the region kites with this slave's offal. It must be that there's nothing in me, I'm totally empty, I'm worthless, or otherwise I would have sliced this guy up and fed the birds in the neighborhood with his insides. That's a powerful image. He's good with words here. But there's the recognition that he cannot do anything. But having thought of his uncle now, we get bloody, bawdy, villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless, villain. Why, what an ass am I. At least Claudius is monumental evil. Hamlet is just an ass. This is extraordinary self-disgust. This is extraordinary self-disgust, nearly overwhelming. This is most brave that I, the son of a dear father murdered, prompted to buy revenge by heaven and hell, look at that, must like a whore unpack my heart with words and fall a cursing like a very drab, a scullion, fie upon it, fa, ha, ha, and words fail finally. He's so disgusted with himself, language breaks down, and we just get fi, fo, bleh. The self-disgust is so great he loses the one thing he does have, which is his articulate nature. About my brain. Okay, get in gear, brain. Get going. Come on, kick in. It's just amazing. But please notice, get going what? Not arm, not body, brain. It's all interior. The problem is here. The problem is thought. The problem has to do with thinking. That problem has to do with thinking, okay? I'm backing up now for a deliberate reason. I'm back to the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern scene, okay? Where he first welcomes them, where Hamlet first sees them, where they first come into him. And he asks them what they're doing in prison. They say, prison, my lord. He says, Denmark's a prison. Then is the world one, Hamlet says, a goodly one, in which there are many confines, wards, and dungeons, Denmark being one of the worst. We think not so, my lord. Why then, 'tis none to you. Oh, it's a prison for me. You don't think so? Well, then it's not a prison for you. For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. To me, it is a prison. And here we have that notion that comes about when exterior moral order collapses, when there is no external truth, good and bad reside only in the individual human skull. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Hamlet is, this is where the doubt has led him. To the point of thinking that, well, there's nothing out there that's good, there's nothing out there that's bad, I'll just think about it and make it so. Oh God, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space were it not that I have bad dreams. The trouble is my thoughts keep getting really unpleasant. But my point is this, he is bound up in a world of thought. And what has defined that world of thought? Doubt about everything. Which has led him to the position at the end of Act 2 in which we find himself. And now he's saying, okay, get the brain going. It's all I've got. All that's left of me is my brain. I got to think about something. And he decides that he will try to figure out whether or not Claudius is guilty by watching him at the play. We'll act out something like the murder. We'll put that special speech in. And at that point, a judgment can be made as to whether or not Claudius is guilty, which of course means he does not trust the ghost, and the scene ends. He puts his brain in order and comes up with a moment of clarity. The spirit that I have seen may be the devil, and the devil hath power to assume a pleasing shape. Yea, and perhaps out of my weakness and my melancholy, as he is very potent with such spirits, abuses me to damn me. That is a moment of clarity. He kicks his brain in gear, has a clear thought. I'll have grounds more relative, not relative in our sense of relativity, but more conclusive, more positive. I'll have grounds more relative than this. The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. And he has risen at least, having hit a real low point. He is at least now going to force himself to go to the play, watch Claudius, and attempt to make some judgment as to the truth of the accusation the ghost has brought. He is going to have to make this determination on his own and not just take the ghost's words, because he doubts the ghost. The doubt is extended outward again, and he at least has the good sense to doubt the ghost. But the fact of the matter is, it is an extension of this world of doubt. Every single thing in his world is being doubted. Everything he thought he had is failing him. He is leading an interior life. That's all that's going on in there. Is that inside. And we're back to that external, internal again. I'm going to do one quick thing with Act 3, Scene 1, and then I'll break right before the to-be or not-to-be soliloquy. It begins, of course, with with Polonius and the king hiding themselves and sending out Ophelia to Hamlet. Okay, let's put her out there. You know, here's bait. Let's see if he takes it. Then we'll watch him and see how he behaves. So that Polonius gives the order. We're about 30, 40 lines into the Act 3, Scene 1. Polonius gives the order to his daughter. Ophelia, walk you here. Gracious, so please you, we will bestow ourselves. He says to the king, we'll go hide ourselves. We'll have her walk. She's following her father's orders again. She is always obedient. Read on this book. That show of such an exercise may color your loneliness. We've got to have a reason for you walking up here in this castle hallway. So read a book. Here, take a book. Read a book. Then there'll be a reason why you're just wandering up and down by yourself. Polonius says, we are off to blame in this. 'Tis too much proved that with devotion's visage and pious action, we do sugar o'er the devil himself. And again, the notion is, it's just too easy to put on a pious front when underneath there's something really demonic. And it's a description again of the whole court. And what's he doing? He's saying, however, Ophelia put on a pious front. Well, she's pious underneath as well. But it's what sets her apart from the rest of the court. She is the innocent, and she is about to be used as bait to catch the big fish, Hamlet. Polonius's words, however, spark the following in the king, who in an aside says, oh, 'tis too true. How smart a lash that speech doth give my conscience. And we find out that Claudius has a conscience. The harlot's cheek, beautied with plastering art, is not more ugly to the thing that helps it than is my deed to my most painted word. Just as the whore puts on makeup to look pretty when she's rotten underneath, everything I'm saying is covering up the rottenness of what's inside me, says Claudius. It is the beginning here in Act 3 of Shakespeare opening up Claudius to us, who's going to become much more complicated than we had assumed he was going to be. Oh, heavy burden, he says. And the famous soliloquy comes next. I'll pick up with that in the next lecture.